Hey, what's up, y'all? This is part two of a two-part episode with Andre. Hope you've heard the first one already. If not, go listen to that now. That's a previous episode. And if so, then just dig on in. I want to ask a question that I hope when I ask it, I don't set you up to get yourself in trouble.
Oh, God. Okay, sure. Go ahead.
What is your feeling on Black journalism in Canada versus Black journalism here? Because...
To the extent that it even exists?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, because I feel like you guys have less of a Black journalism scene there, but it's a scene where somebody like you can come into prominence, who I feel is somebody who's would be way out of the mold coming up in American journalism. I feel like someone like you would have a harder time, because I feel like they're picking a very narrow type of guy or girl to represent Black Americans in journalism here. You know what I'm saying?
Here, like, journalism is just like a job. It's not, from what I understood from, I don't know, maybe it's my own romanticizing of journalism. I'm not a journalist or anything, but I always ascribe to it a kind of nobility, like where it's a very necessary thing. And it's an honorable profession. And I don't think people treat it that way anymore. It's just a job, and it's a stepping stone to really what they really want to do is, just get a big check.
I was being facetious earlier when I said to the extent that it exists, because there are Black publications throughout Canada. I mean, maybe they're not as, widely known as like Essence or like Ebony, The Root, etc. And how you all feel about The Root? I feel a lot of the same way about them, to be frank.
Actually, Essence, Root.
Can get into that if you really want to. But the thing is, like, a lot of our publications here are so community-based because they're small. Like, there's there's a new publication that was just started called The Clarion, and it was like out of the Afro Nova Scotian community. So like the Nova Scotian community in Canada is composed of this, like, a lot of it is descendants of Black loyalists that fought for England in the Revolutionary War. And so they were promised their own territory in Canada if they were to fight for England. And they were basically shunted to a nearly inhospitable spit of land in Nova Scotia. But
That's a very undertold story. I only found out about that like 2 years ago.
Well, they actually they did a really good piece a little while back saying that Halifax is not, this is not Canada's Mecca. Like, if you're looking for the promised land in Canada, like, we're not it. There's a lot of stuff here that you're dealing with in your own communities too. So don't romanticize us, which I really do respect them for saying that. But there's two journalism grads out there, Sandra Hannenbaum and Tunde Balogun. So they started the Objective News Agency for the purpose of creating like a Black owned and Black centered publication. One of my really good friends, who I'm also in business with, Roger Dundas and his wife Camille Dundas, they started a publication called BuyBlacks.com, which is basically like a digital and online publication. I do write for them occasionally. I've edited for them as well. But it's like, it's so hard to establish a media foothold here versus I think there is like a tradition of Black journalism in the United States that it's like we had it in fits and starts in Canada. And I think because mainstream news just tends to like swallow and assimilate everything, like it appears and then it disappears, whereas I think in the US, especially like in the post-World War II years, there was just a very strong strain of journalism that was rooted in post-abolitionism and out of that liberation theology ethic, that it stuck around. And here we don't really have that to the extent. That's not to diminish anyone's publications here. It's just I find there's a much stronger strand of journalism that exists in the U.S.
Yeah, I think a problem is happening with the U.S. now, and I'm trying to phrase this in a way so I don't put you in a position to have to get into trouble with anybody, so I'm trying to be diplomatic.
But all the people that I can get in trouble with, I'm already in trouble with.
Okay, because the way I feel is, like, probably up until the 90s, we used to have a really good Black public intellectual class that didn't agree with each other a lot. Have a lot of public arguments, but at the end of the day, could get along and respect each other. And you would see like panels, and it'd be like Malcolm X with somebody from Ebony Magazine, with I think it was A. Philip Randolph. There's a very famous panel where they're from, you know, assimilationists to
Understand that, like, yeah. You understand that, you know, the Niagara movement took place on our side of Niagara Falls. Like, the Niagara movement that led to the formation of the NAACP was in Fort Erie, right? So, like, we do have a tradition of that. I think the I see kind of what it is that you're getting at. There is, I think, a very healthy establishment for public intellectualism in the US, and I think that HBCUs are like the bedrock of that. Like, of course, there's neighborhood organizations, and there have been like religious and Black Power movements. Like, I'm not taking anything away from that, but I'm saying you have an educational and intellectual foothold in HBCUs, but we don't have HBCUs here. And it seems like the ones that that appear and crop up here, like in the late 1960s and 1970s, and to an extent the 1980s, you had a lot of that popping up in Ontario and in Nova Scotia. Like, I've been involved with two of these organizations. One is the Jamaican Canadian Association, another is the Black Business and Professionals Association. Like, you had a movement and a groundswell of people came to this country, saw that their interests were not being served, and said, you know what, fuck it, let's just do it ourselves. But it becomes so hard to maintain it. And I think there's something that you will do in the United States that people don't do as much here. And that's that you will support your own. So, you know, people will join up with and support the NAACP. It's just a tradition. Like, it's something that you do. You may have your complaints about the organization, but people see the importance in it existing. People will send their children off to HBCUs. I think because Canada's Black population started off so small and then experienced like a boom when the immigration laws were changed here in 1976, I believe. So you had a lot of people coming here from the Caribbean. So you had like a huge wave of Black people that came here, right? So you have like multiple waves of Black people that come to Canada. But a lot of us who are around now are, you know, second generation, third generation. So there's not as long of a history versus in the US, like you've been there for hundreds of years. And I think that's the difference.
But what happens with, and this is kind of what I was trying to get at, is what happens when the people who have the lineage to that old tradition that was here are the ones carrying it now, which I think is kind of the problem. You kind of have, like, I feel like we had all of this before, and they created a space for these voices, right? And I had the names wrong. It was a PBS program called The Open Mind, and on a two-hour episode, it's a round table, they had Malcolm X, James Farmer, Wyatt T. Walker, and Alan...
I remember, I've seen that video.
Morrison, yeah. 2 hours long. And even on something like PBS today, I don't think you would see that. Today would be like two people at a septum ring. And like the diversity of thought that would be... And the white person would be like, you know, very banal. Like, you know, it would be just like...
Even though I like him, it would be a Chris Hayes.
Yeah. It would be a Chris Hayes. It would be someone like Damon Young from Young... very smart brothers. Yeah. It would be like two people with septum rings and maybe Ira Madison. And that would be like the panel. If we were lucky, maybe Ta-Nehisi Coates and Jamel Bowie, maybe, you know, who are both, you know, very intelligent, but I can't see them really having a fight with each other, you know?
Well, here's, okay. And there's a lot of people who disagree with me on this. Like, I have, you know, like colleagues in journalism and in, you know, advocacy here that really disagree with me on this. But I honestly do not feel that it's productive to have conversations about Black issues in front of white people. I just don't. I don't think that they shouldn't be able to participate. They shouldn't be able to observe. That's something that we have to be able to sort out among ourselves. And I think, whatever, I may get in trouble for this. I don't give a fuck. I'm almost 40.
I agree with you.
I'm almost 40 years old, man. I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
I'm 41. So I'm jumping off the bridge with you.
Exactly. It's like when you have kids and you get close to your 40s, it's like, man, the only thing that matters to me is like my children in front of me. All the other stuff is really, they can go to hell. But I think there's a degree of aspirationalism where it's like you want to impress white people and get them on your side. But the problem becomes like you want to get white people on your side and then recruit them against those other niggers who are holding
you back. Yeah, that's a big problem.
I hate that. And the thing is like, and I've had like huge arguments about this before. Like, there's an organization here called the Federation of Black Canadians, and there are legitimate criticisms of the Federation of Black Canadians, you know, and the people who've organized them and the work that they've done so far. There are some seriously legitimate criticisms that I think should have been lodged. What I did not like and what I didn't agree with was taking those criticisms of the Federation of Black Canadians out into the public square for all Canadians to have an opinion on. I don't believe in that shit.
But yeah, see, I'm going to slightly differ with you on that, but in a minor way. I don't really like always inviting white people into black conversations or showing up for white people to try to throw another bunch of black people under the bus, which is what I feel like a lot of that that blue check class does. You know, try to write articles.
They want to do it for head pats.
Yeah, they want to do head pats, and they want to make sure that no other group of black people is in danger of taking their slot as mascot, you know, with white people. But I do think if you're going to talk serious politics, sooner or later, you're going to have to bring it into the public arena. Like for example, what Yvette Carnell's doing. Mm-hmm. If she wants to get reparations really happening, if it's like that, like if you could talk about toxic masculinity and whether black men wake up and beat black women from the time they get up to the time they go to sleep, that's just airing out dirty laundry and being salacious.
It's not even airing dirty laundry. It's like it's spreading falsehoods about your own people to push.
Yeah, yeah.
For I don't even know what reason, but yeah.
Yeah, that's dirtying the laundry yourself.
Yeah.
And then airing the dirty laundry because it's not even real dirty laundry. It's fake. And that's true. I shouldn't have said airing dirty laundry because that implies that it's true, which I didn't mean to do.
No.
But yeah. But that's what I mean. Like I felt like this open mind round table, that was at a critical moment when black people were fighting for political rights, and it became kind of unavoidable to include white people in the conversation because it's like, are we gonna go?
Oh, they can be included in the conversation.
Yeah.
As far as like when you talk about the criticisms of what's going on within.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You know what? I like and respect Yvette Carnell. Like, generally, I get along with people. Like, as a general rule, I try to get along with people as best I can because it's like whether or not I agree with them, like whether or not I will agree with what they say. At the end of the day, they're still black, and it's just important for me to protect black people. Like, I don't really care if I agree.
Well, you
with
know,
them or
even
not.
Neely Fuller, he's got a phrase called was it guarantee
BGQ.
VGQ, guarantee qualification to speak on, you know?
Yeah.
So I
understand why Carnell might turn some people off, but it's like, she's dedicating herself, like she's not just out for self. Like she's trying to do something for her people that really work. I think, you know, the worst you can say about her is that she's abrasive.
Yeah.
But it's like, but you get to be like, when you're involved in the kind of struggle that she's involved in, you get to be abrasive. Like I look at somebody
gotta put a little of that sensitivity away, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't allow ourselves to have the humanity, like just because she's abrasive to people who are pan-Africanists or people who are basically coming at her sideways, it's like, but that doesn't discredit anything. Like she has, like, why is it that she's not allowed to express the full range of human emotions? As long as she's not doing something to harm you, then just leave her alone.
And that's kind of the problem. Like the Joy Reid and those people who are trying to do a public disinformation campaign against Yvette Carnell, they're not trying to do it to kind of bring some kind of real politics to the fore. Like they're not doing it because they have an ask of white people. They're just doing it to preserve the status quo, as in, we want to seat at the table.
The gatekeepers and
you want to be the gatekeepers. We want to be the appointed. That's a perfect example of the manager of white people. We want to be the manager of black people. We want to be the manager of black people. We want to keep the status quo and get a seat at the table. And we need to marginalize these other black people. So they're kind of having conversations in front of white people in order to kind of be cultural tour guides. Or that type of stuff.
Oh my God! Yeah, I really. Sometimes when I read articles that people write, or when I see news segments, the first question I have to ask is like, who is this for? So the way that Joy Reid went after Yvette Carnell and the ADOS people, my question is like, who is this for? Are you doing this to inform black people about what this ADOS movement is and the danger that you believe it poses? Because I don't believe that. I think what
she never talked. She never talked about
disdainful from the jump.
It's mobilizing the opinions of white people against this movement before it gains any traction. For what reason, I don't know.
This is what I think it is. I think, right, this is the problem. White people, these white Democrats, and I think she's in the centrist Hillary camp, they can't come out and attack the ADOS because it's going to look bad. So what she's doing, because normally she just talks like a white Democrat in blackface. She doesn't even talk about black issues, you know? She acts and talks just like a white Democrat who just happens to be black, right? So suddenly her week after week, you know, talking about what's good for black people, it doesn't it doesn't pass the smell test.
Exactly. It's not a conversation that they're qualified to have because they haven't put the work in.
They haven't put the work in. They haven't had a tendency to have it. And what she's
that's why they really want to reject this conversation, kind of steer it into a direction that they can control, because it's like this is a ground up kind of movement. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
They have no connection to the ground.
And it's like these white people, they can't attack Adia West. So what she's doing is she comes on with a bunch of black people and says that these are a bunch of bots and trolls and not real, then the white people can say, well, look, these black people are saying it. Now we don't have to talk about reparations.
Exactly.
And right. I think that's what she's doing.
Well, I didn't want to bring this up, but screw it. I'm going to bring it up anyway, because it's been on my mind. It's really gotten under my skin and bothering me. And before I bring it up, I just want to say, if anybody like is listening to this and feels they want to come at me sideways, like, I'm a fucking queer black male myself, so piss off. But when I saw, and I do not like attacking black people in public. I really do not. I prefer to have like a face-to-face or a one-on-one conversation. But when I saw that George M. Johnson article on Nipsey Hussle, my blood. Because again,
I wanted to put hands on that guy. I've wanted to get physical with that guy.
Boiled.
I want to add one thing before you proceed.
Yeah,
right? The reason why I think this is different about having a conversation in front of white people, they already started the conversation. So you're doing damage control. And I think that's different when you're reactively trying to do damage control against a damaging narrative that's been introduced in white spaces.
Who asked you to do that, though?
That's exactly.
Who was it that wanted you to write this piece? Because it's like, I think it's fair. Like, if you want to have a conversation about homophobia in the black community, although, like, you know, a lot of evidence points towards homophobia being less of a problem in our community than others, but that's besides the point. Yeah. If you want to have a conversation, I think it's legit to open that up.
It's a valid conversation to have.
It is. You absolutely have to have that conversation.
But having a good faith.
But having the conversation by dragging a dead man's name. He made one comment. And here's, and I want to like get into the granularity of this in a second. But if somebody makes one homophobic comment, I'm not saying that the person is excused or that the conversation can't be had. But when you want to drag his name into, we have to talk about toxic masculinity and how he died. But then on top of that, and this is the part that really just like twisted a knife in my gut. Connecting that to Ed Buck's victims. What the?
Where the hell are you?
Didn't even try to make implausible correlation. He just said it like it just made sense.
He just dropped it like
he said. Yeah. You can draw a straight line, and it's like what you had 750 words to draw that straight line, and I still don't see it. What straight line are you talking about?
He didn't even try to draw a straight line. A
homophobic comment without qualification. Sure, it was homophobic. We'll get into that in a second. That comment, what effect did that comment have on Ed Buck? Like, do you think Ed Buck was like reading Nipsey Hussle's Instagram? Was like, oh, wow.
Agenda? Oh, I kill another one now.
Yeah. What? Okay, that's the kind of stuff where I say, who is this for? Like, who did you write this for? Did you write it for black people to have a conversation about homophobia? No. Or did you pick a conversation with black people, many of whom in North America are in grief right now? You're picking a fight with them to raise a conversation about homophobia that is never going to get accomplished because now people are just pissed off at you.
And it was
that,
so.
And that's the whole thing about that. It's like you know, when you come at people with bad faith, it's just like you turn people off the whole. And it shouldn't be that way. He doesn't represent the whole LGBT whatever, but he don't represent the whole group.
But it's like,
but
you
it's
know,
like,
I
it makes it easy for people to be dismissive of the whole group because of insane shit like that.
Well, like Raquel,
it's insane for him to even make the comparison. I read it and I was like, what?
Again, my only question,
I could draw a straight line. I'm like,
yeah.
Where's the line at? I missed it.
He didn't even try to draw.
I'm the smartest guy in the room, but
there is a line. First of all, like he was talking about, like, you know, Terry Crews. He was talking about a comment that JC made back in the day. Like there was no line there. It's do you ever seen that meme?
It was a laundry list.
Yeah. There's a meme with oh my god, what's dude's face from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia? But he's like
I know what you mean.
He's in a room, Charlie.
Charlie.
He's in a room. He's got like these maps and like this like yarn drawing lines from like one item to another item to another item. And he's like ranting, and it looks like he's in a conspiracy theory. It was like that is the line you're drawing. That's what you look like right now.
What's scary about that article was it was so
Charlie Day. I'm sorry, that's the guy's name.
Yeah. It was so full of links that didn't really have anything to do with each other, except that you can arguably try to use them to say black men are trash. It made me realize he must keep a Google Doc or something with just that's probably titled Black Men Are Trash that he just keeps adding years of links to, because I'm like, how did one day they come up with
years of links? Yeah. If you're going to make a substantive criticism of homophobia in the Black community, and this is, you know, stuff that I've talked about as well and I've written about as well. If you're going to make a substantive criticism of it, it's got to be very precise because, getting into what Nipsey said in that Instagram post, like, he talked about, like, they're not being, there's no agenda here, right? So there's no, like, you know, gangsters or violent people or there's no, you know, LGBTQ, there's no agenda.
I can read it because in front of me. Okay. And this is something that we might differ a little bit on because mm-hmm. I think there is a conversation to be had about whether it actually was homophobic or the degree to which it was homophobic. And I think one of the problems
I see where you're going with this. Here's what I'll say.
Yeah.
I think that for somebody like, okay, so my major, you know, before I finished in poli sci, my major was communications, right? So I've had the ability to like study, you know, Marshall McLuhan and Chomsky, et cetera. Like I have had that exposure, right?
He's not going to be as precise.
Right. There's a lot of people who
a guy like you would be.
There's people who understand fundamentally when there's something not okay, like when they feel that there is a type of representation that's being used against them. People can, I think, understand that on a fundamental and visceral level, but they might lack the
nuance,
the framework. Yeah, they might lack the academic framework and the nuance to explain it. So it's like I got immediately what he was trying to say. Now, granted, is it homophobic? Okay, sure. Yeah, I will grant it that, whether you want to argue with that or not. But here's the thing. It's like, for a lot of Black men out there, it's like, and there are some bad actors who will try to draw this as like, oh, you know, this is just them trying to buck break you. And what it really is it's almost like the narrative and the visual of a straight Black male equates to danger. Like, they're dangerous, they're vicious, they're thugs, they're predators, etc. And I think
the weakest link
in the revolution. And it's like people grow up seeing this stuff said about themselves so often. And what I really hate is, like, people try to have a monopoly on what masculinity looks like. And I think that your masculinity should look like whatever you want it to look like. But it's like, we're always trying to fix and change and improve Black men. But it's like, can you just not let them be men in whatever expression makes sense to them? And I think where it comes to...
They can't fix us using the same old white supremacist tropes about, you know, the rampant homophobia and, you know, sexual predation and all that stuff.
But it's like,
making us the face of every ill.
Yeah. I think that, you know, there's an argument to be had about, you know, whether some of that stuff is productive or not. But I don't really want to get into that. I think what it is like, if you're just like a regular working class person that grows up and is constantly being told there's something wrong with you, you're not okay, you need to be fixed. And on the other side of not being fixed, what they're seeing is you die. Like, you will die at the hands of another Black man. You will die at the hands of police. You will die at the hands of a vigilante. And in some way, you brought that upon yourself just because of who you are and did not fix yourself. And I think when people say that there's an agenda, it's like, what you're saying to me is, if I see myself represented in film, television, the news, etc., if I don't get away from what your image of me being a predator looks like, then I'm going to die and you're going to say I deserved it. And I think that's kind of what he was getting at.
Yeah, I'll read the paragraph itself, because I agree with a lot of what you said. But okay, so he says, demonstration speaks louder than conversation. He wrote under a photo of a group of Black youth. Mm-hmm. They're gonna feed us every image of our men and boys but this one. So he's saying they're gonna feed us every image of Black men except for this one. So he says, no hyperviolent, no homosexual, no abandoners, just strong.
I think he said that because, you know, gay men are perceived to be more docile and innocent. You know, like you said, the
street. There was actually a study that was recently released that showed that if Black men are perceived to be gay in the workplace, people will sort of let their guard down. Like
Well, not just that. They get deracialized, what the story says.
Yeah,
people
they're seen as less Black.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can draw from what you will from those conclusions. But I think what that does say to some straight Black men, it's a little bit of indication. It's like, so if I'm a straight Black male, I'm a threat to you. And it's like,
automatically, regardless.
But there's so much scholarship showing that that's the case. That if you're a straight Black male, you are automatically a threat. And I don't understand why we can't simply acknowledge this.
But like, the case I was trying to make here is if, okay, like, you know, when someone says, hey, look at this movie, it has Black women in it and it has so-and-so in it, you know, it has representation as opposed to just white men. And then someone says, oh, wait, so you're saying that you hate white men? I felt like the backlash was kind of veering into that, that by him saying, look, he's representation of straight black men who, for once, who aren't hyper-violent or abandoners around the down low. I think people, in a way, kind of did to him what they do to people who celebrate diversity or people who say Black Lives Matter. So people are like, oh, wait a minute. So you're saying that white lives don't matter? And I think that was kind of, but the one thing that I will say I thought was arguably homophobic was to say just strong black men, because then that kind of implies that if you're homosexual black man, you can't be strong.
Well, I'll put I'll put it to you this way. Like I you know, I'm queer myself, but I...
This is a common thought
like
process.
I code is very straight. Like, people just assume that I'm straight. I'm okay with that. Like, you know, it's not a big deal. Like, I don't expect people to just, like, know how I identify and so forth. But I think that...
I just wait for somebody to tell me. I'm don't ask, don't tell. If you feel like telling me, cool.
Whatever. I
don't guess. I don't speculate. I don't care what you do.
But the thing is, like, my experience with that is like nobody's ever said anything. No one has ever, literally ever, said anything sideways to me about it. Like ever. Like in my own family, like, you know, two of my cousins are queer, right? Yeah. And you know, when one of my cousins came out to her mom was like, "I was waiting for you to tell me." Like it just hasn't been a thing.
A lot of people don't be surprised.
Yeah, they don't be. And the thing is, I think people really want to believe that that every black person is just deathly afraid to come out to their family and to their community. Right. When it's like, but like if you go to, if
you
go
I don't
to,
like, even have to come out because we already know.
People know.
You've been double dutching, and you know, we know.
That's the thing. Know. People generally, but the thing is, I think there's a lot of people who experience significant trauma in the process of coming out. I would say this,
or even before coming out, like which you know.
Yeah. But I think even when like they are honest with their families, that some of their family, and I think this really has more to do with religiosity than blackness. Like, as you go up the scale of religiosity, then you get your reactions. And I think some people have such a bad experience with their families and with their communities, either when they come out or when they are outed, that they universalize their experience onto everybody else. And I think in the same way that it's not fair for me to universalize my experience and say, okay, but when I came out, like nobody really cared, so therefore I can't draw any broader conclusions from that. And I think it's really not fair in the opposite direction.
I think something too is when he said, people said that he talked about a gay agenda, but he just said an agenda, and he clarified later that he wasn't saying the agenda came from gay people. You said it was the media and representation
coming from
the
media.
He was saying that the media wasn't representing straight black men in a positive light. And he clarified that he has like gay friends and family, and he has no problems with the gay lifestyle. And I think the problem of changing the word agenda to gay agenda is I think gay agenda evokes a different thing, where people imagine a nefarious gay cabal themselves trying to turn people gay. And he made clear, I don't think it's gay people trying to hypnotize black men into gayness or convert black men into gayness. He's saying that I have no problems with gay black men. I feel like it's the media who's choosing to show violent black male images, gay black men images, and deadbeat dad black male images, but not just the regular.
And there's no space for us.
And like, I do think that, you know, with the strong black men thing and some other things, and with the lack of nuance, you can make an argument that there's homophobia or a degree of homophobia, but I feel like these people were just taking the worst caricature of homophobia, like some kind of Christian right Westboro style, and just painting him with that without allowing people to, was it homophobic at all even? Or if it was, what was the degree? What was the specifics of the homophobia? Because none of these articles, even the ones that are defending him, are even saying what he was really accused of, really, or breaking down the nuance. And even a white gay guy got into an argument with me, and then when I made my case, he actually said, you know what? I was wrong. I actually didn't know any of what you said.
I think, okay, so this kind of goes back to what I was saying about, you know, like just just regular working class black people maybe not necessarily having the framework to explain this stuff. I think here's, okay, when you talk about the gay agenda, you associate that with religiosity, i.e. like, you know, fundamentalist Christians will say that there's an agenda to make our children.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say, because I come from the Caribbean community, a lot of people do actually believe that because they're also very religious, right?
Yeah, they believe that. But I think there is a,
But yeah, but let me get through this. So, but here's the thing. I think what a lot of people are trying to say as well is that there is an agenda to demonize the black male who is not gay, who is not trans, who,
straight black.
And there's also like, you know, and the way that we get demonized is by, you know, talking about us as absentee fathers and talking about us as being hyperviolent, etc. And I think that simply is going to require the language of like separating what it is that you mean by agenda. Because when you say stuff like my own foster brother, you know, would say, and members of my own family would say things like, well, you don't think there's an agenda? There's no agenda. Yeah. I'm like, but what are you talking about when you say agenda? Like,
yeah, and
our last premier of Ontario, like the one before the one we had right now, you know, she's a lesbian woman, right? Kathleen Wynne. And a lot of people would say, like, on the sly, that she was trying to, you know, impose the gay agenda on our children by changing the sex ed curriculum to talk about LGBTQ issues. Some people are very open with that stuff, so I understand how it is hurtful when you hear it from like your own family and your own community. But I think that for people who know better, and people who understand communications that way, and people who understand the socio-political implications of what happens when you demonize black communities that way, especially for black males, then you can exercise a little bit of compassion, I think, to really get down to what it is you're talking about.
Yeah.
A lot of this is bad.
I think something else that happens too is he's not with the tools or the nuance maybe to speak to the white educated middle-class gays, but this wasn't a message for them. Like this to me, when black person who is of the class and place where he's from, I think they got it instantly. And that's kind of the problem. Like white people can't fathom that something might not be directed toward them, or that maybe I don't understand something. Maybe I don't have the tools to understand this message. Like, you know, because here's one of the problems I have. I feel like white people in general have this bad tendency that they can't think of a black unique view on something that can be thought out and make sense. Like they have to slot it into the closest white version of that argument. So the idea, there is no existing white argument about, well, maybe there is to a degree, but it's more bad faith. You know, when someone says they're eliminating straight white men, positive straight white male role models from TV and movies. If a white guy says that, of course that looks and sounds ridiculous, you know? And I think from most of the times when you hear like a white guy say something that says agenda, you think of like that parodied version, that gay agenda, they're going to turn us gay. And I also agree that I think there's a lot of black people even who actually do sincerely believe that, especially if you go into the Caribbean side of things. There are a lot of people who really think someone's trying to put something in the water to make people gay, like, you know.
Yeah. I hear this stuff too, right? So I'm not going to act like it doesn't exist. It definitely does. I hear it firsthand, especially when people don't know, like when they think that I'm straight too, they start like going off on these little tangents and I'm like, would you expect me to agree with you?
Yeah.
But there's something you said there that really struck a chord. It's when you say that white people try to slot our conversations into what it is that they know. So they filter what it is that we're saying. And I actually even have said this like in conversations with a journalist, not about necessarily about homophobia, but it's like when I say something in an article that I write, you're not reading what it is that I'm saying. You're filtering it through what it is that you think it means rather than engaging with what I actually said. And I think like when I see, for example, because we do it too, when I see people saying that, we dragged John McCain after he died. And it's like, so your analog to Nipsey Hussle and why it's okay to have that kind of conversation after, like 24 hours after he passes away, is John McCain. But does Nipsey Hussle have the power, for example, to try and shut down the border, to quote unquote build the danged fence? Did he have the power in his hands to fuck up your healthcare system? Like, did Nipsey Hussle vote so that Martin Luther King Day would not become a holiday? Like, does he have the kind of political power and clout that John McCain has? Absolutely not. But it's like, you want to force the analogy because it fits into what you know.
White people always looking for a false equivalent to any type of similar. Yeah. You know, black people are just as racist too. You know, we want to equate name calling with racism.
But it also, as I think, because like a lot of this stuff is so reductionist, and I don't know if it's on purpose so that like the person who shouts the loudest will get the most attention, or it's because they just don't have the ability to have nuanced conversations. But like a lot of it ends up becoming so reductionist that it dehumanizes people. Like, it strips people of their experience when you do something like that. You know what I mean? And it's like, and I know that, you know, if somebody listens to this, they might come back later and say, well, you know, this is just a bunch of black men caping for other black men. But honestly, like, I try to have as much compassion for my people and for my community as I can. And if you can't exercise that, then what are you doing? Like, what do you think liberation actually looks like
when they understand that, because they do the same thing.
Well, I mean, if there's a class of people that you're basically going to just write them off and leave them behind, then what do your liberation politics actually mean?
Nothing. Yeah, I want to change to a slightly lighter note. I want to talk about, please. I want to end it talking about black pop culture in Canada and how it compares to America, because there's been kind of a convergence. And
well, how much experience you got in America, Andre?
I used to live in South Florida, actually, for a number of years. Did you guys hear about this story? There was a father who got a panicked phone call from his son, and his son said that, like, a teacher hit him, and then the teacher, like, grabbed the phone and knocked it out of his hands or something, and then the father rolled up on his school with the Draco. It wasn't just a gun. It was like an AK-47. That was my little sister's school.
Sisters
went to Bear Lakes in West Palm Beach, Florida. You know, so I lived there for quite a while. So, like, you know, and
but I also think, even if you're not in America, our soft culture is so dominant that you kind of end up automatically versed in our culture. It shocks me how well people know American culture. Like, I have cousins and nephews in Haiti asking me to send them movies and videos, and they'll know what's going on the ground level better than me. I'm like, how the fuck do you even know all this shit?
Yeah, your media is very dominant, but the thing is, in Canada especially, because, like, if you look at like the population spread in Canada, like, where people are geographically located, like, we have such a gigantic territory. Like, we're one of the biggest countries in the world, but the population lives in, like, this ribbon that borders the United States, you know. So we are heavily dominated by your news media. That's why we know so much, and I guess that's also why you don't really know much about us, because you don't live on the border with Canada. You live everywhere.
I lived in Buffalo for a while, so we used to go into Canada.
I'm so sorry.
Tell me about it. But the best part about living in Buffalo is going to Toronto.
Hey, Rick James is from Buffalo.
I'm not gonna tell a story. There was I know somebody who knew Rick James, and it's a whole different story.
I feel like everybody in Buffalo has a Rick James story, the way that everybody in Toronto has a Drake story.
so you gotta tell us your Drake story later. But one thing we used to like going to Toronto was I don't know if this is still the case, but Mike, I don't know if you know this, but there was a period a lot of the really beautiful, beautiful video girls used to be from Toronto. I don't know why. They just recruit a lot of Toronto girls to be in the video back in the days. I don't know. I don't think that's still the case, but that was the case for a while. But we used to go...
Well, Ludacris alluded to that, and hoes in different areas.
Okay.
416 was in there.
Toronto's got some beautiful hoes.
We used to go up there, right? And the women would be, like, way, way, way more beautiful, but you could talk to them, like, really easy, you know? And... It was like way different. And
well, if you're American, we still war about this.
And I remember this would be a type of conflict, you know what I mean? Because on top of that, American guys are just thirsty. Like we thought we had game, but looking back and older, we were just thirsty. Like in my experience, Canadian guys weren't that thirsty. Like we would show up and just hit on everything with the pulse, you know? Canadian guys were, you know, were just kind of like chill and laying the cut. But yeah, it was cleaner. We used to like hanging out there, and then Caravana just kept getting worse. Caravana would happen, and that thing got worse every year. I remember
Caravana is actually it's
has it dialed back?
It had its low points. Yeah. Like it had its low points for a while, I would say, like during the mid to late 90s, and then it experienced a resurgence.
Oh, that's good.
The thing about, and I know that you wanted to conclude on this topic, but you know, if you're gonna talk about pop culture, like I think Caravana explains Canada in a very succinct way as far as black pop culture.
This is totally what I want to talk about, so please go ahead.
Yeah, Caravana was created by an organization of people from mostly from Trinidad, actually. Like most of them were Trinidadian, but a lot of them were Jamaican as well. And the idea was that they were going to have like a cultural festival to showcase Caribbean culture to Canada. It was almost like a, hey, we're okay.
Yeah,
like,
it makes sense.
Yeah. But at the same time, it was the extent to which like collective action existed in Canada, I think it was stronger and more cohesive in the 60s through the 90s than it is now. The idea for collective action with Caravana was that, you know, it was going to be a tourist attraction, bring a lot of money in, but they were going to take that money and disperse it through the community. So like, you know, for people who needed help with housing, you know, kids who needed school books, et cetera, like that was the idea, was to take the money from Caravana and create collective action. Almost like like the Black Panther school lunch program, something like that, right? I think that's the template that they were working off of. And what ended up happening in the early 2000s, because like for a very long time, it was just like, well, where's the money going? Like all this, we're generating like $500 million in tourism revenue, you know, and a lot of this money is going towards the bands themselves. Like you pay a lot of money for those costumes. You pay for like being able to cut the line and get in and play mass with them and so forth. Where's all the money going? And for a very long time, the Caravana Cultural Committee could not explain where the money was going. So the city of Toronto basically took the parade away from them. And handed it over to another carnival-like organization. It's not the same thing as Caravana, which is why it's now called Carnival.
Oh, again, so it's not called Caravana anymore.
No, they call it the Caribbean Carnival, and it'll be like named after like the corporate sponsor. For, so for a very long time, it was called the Scotiabank
Caribbean Carnival. Oh, that's terrible. Is it true? There's a lot more white people at it now? I heard like a lot more white people.
There's a lot of white people, but I wouldn't say that there's more. Okay. Like I played Moss like up until like a couple years ago, and I might even go back this year. Who knows? Okay. But you know, it ended up becoming like this huge garish attraction, like Mardi Gras almost, except that there was. Like the whatever sort of cultural significance that it held has almost been lost entirely. Like a lot of people don't even like to go to Caravana here. They'll go to like Carnival in Trinidad. They'll go to Cropover in Barbados, etc.
Yeah, because even me as a visitor, because I used to go to visit Toronto just on regular weekends, just for fun. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so to me, I wasn't one of those people who just came during Caravana. Like I would just go to Toronto regularly and occasionally go to Caravana. And then I remember I stopped wanting to go to Caravana just because it got too ratchet and American. I'm like, I can just stay in America and...
Listen, man, the amount of American people that would come up... Listen, first of all, we play soca music at Caravana. Yeah. Soca rhythms. You all would come up here and like suavemente behind the girls, trying to do some merengue shit. Yeah. I don't know. Yo, it's very, fucked up the whole show.
Very true. And that was going to lead to my next question, because you said something very true. Like, if you were American, they would talk to you. I wanted to wonder, did the brand of... American guy go down? Because to me it had to have gone down. Like
we had too much exposure. Too much exposure to Americans. Once you heard about it, you fucked up.
To me, I imagine. Yeah. People probably don't even care about American guys as much as they used to, because too many of them came down and showed their ass.
No, you definitely saturated the market and brought down your market price. It's almost like when I was younger, like in my teens. There was an all-ages nightclub, like outside of Toronto, in a place called Burlington. It was called Energy Kingdom. And Energy Kingdom was just like, if you like wanted your introduction to nightlife as a teenager who was still in high school, that's what you did. Like you found somebody who had a driver's license, you got in the car, you went to Energy Kingdom on the weekend, you got like your underage wristband, you went in and so forth. I remember when I first went there, I was like, yo, this is so hype, because I'd never really been in a nightclub before, right? I was like, yo, there's like gal everywhere.
There's no frame of reference.
Yeah. I was like, I almost lost my mind. I'm like, wait, you people can do this like every weekend? Just go and like hang out around people like dressed like this and dance on each other? This is insane. Like everything before that was all bashment parties. It was all like house parties, almost like that Sean Paul video. Yeah. Get Busy. Yeah, it takes place in somebody's basement. Like my family used to run those parties, right? Yeah. So my mistake was, because at the time I lived in a neighborhood like just outside of Toronto called Malton. If you're a Canadian and you listen to this show, you probably know about Malton Mans. They're like, Malton Mans are for the most part waste, right? So my mistake was going back and telling Malton Mans about Energy Kingdom. All of a sudden, like over the course of like a year,
it was full
the
of
place
them.
Morphed from, yeah. Like, why am I going to drive all the way up to Burlington to go see Malton Peeps?
And
then you just don't want to go anymore.
And they're going to ruin the ratio. Yeah, that's what happened the last time that I finally went to Caravana and I was still single. I was like, wow, this is just like a mess. I was realizing, you know what, that golden era of like American guys being this kind of novelty, because when we used to go, we'd be like one of a few American guys around. It'd be a novelty. And then
And you could tell all kinds of lies about yourself. Yeah, you know, what kind of job you have, how much money you make. You probably went shopping before you came up here in the first place, and we don't really have designer like threads the way that you do. So you came up here looking fresh, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. And I had a friend that would blatantly lie. Like, he would tell lies that didn't even make sense. Like he said he was a record producer, and I think the girls weren't dumb. They were just more kind of naive, because the lies would be so big, you don't even want to believe someone's gonna lie like that, you know. So my friend's in college living in a dorm, and he's like, yeah, you know, I'm a record producer. He's talking to the girl, goes, yeah, you know, I'm seeing these acts. I'm like, dude, you barely have facial hair. There's no way this girl is believing this story. And he was,
And
you know, it's funny. He told a lie so big that he ended up not being able to keep talking to the girl because he's like, okay.
You can't follow up.
Like, what kind of date am I going to take her to? I can't take her to like, the drive-thru. So he kind of talked himself out of even continuing talking. But okay, last thing I want to ask, why Drake?
But just to wrap that part up. You know, you're talking about culture. Yeah. I'm saying that, you know, it's a microcosm. Like, it's something that is huge and well-known. And it's like, that is what Canadian, I would say, like, hip-hop and R&B and generally urban culture is like, is that everybody knows it and everybody loves it. But what benefit does it have to the community? None. Mm. Nothing. For all the money that it generates, the community gets nothing back.
But do you think it's any better in America with Black music and culture?
Well, you have your Nipsey Hussle.
That's true, but
I wrote an article.
Was he an exception or a norm? I wonder. I don't know.
I look at like, you know, what Jay-Z is doing, and as a, you know, as a socialist, like I'm just like, well, you know, kudos to him or whatever. Yeah. But it's like, at least he's
a lot of these guys are making a lot of money though.
But yeah, they're making a lot
these
of money.
These guys are making a lot of money.
But I think,
I mean, guys you haven't even heard of.
Yeah.
They're making nice money.
But first of all, they can make the money in the United States. It's incredibly difficult to make money here in Canada, even if you're like a well-known entertainer. I'll tell you a story in a second, a very brief one. But you know, but they understand the importance of giving back to the community, and I think that. Mm-hmm. That is almost non-existent.
Well, that's
here.
Interesting.
Like Drake, for example, and I wrote a criticism about this in a local paper. You know, he, with the Toronto Raptors, created a program to, I think, like create some basketball courts and create a program so the kids who want to play basketball can. And it's like, okay, but what good is basketball going to do for these kids?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know how hard it is to get into it is one of the most difficult professional sports leagues to get into in the world.
And that's the lamest type of charity, the one where it's like, if I don't give you some activity, you're going to end up in a gang killing somebody. I mean, there is something to that, but you can't really build a nation or politics based on just keeping busy so they don't kill themselves. Like, you know.
Well, it's not, but here's the thing. It's not just that it's patronizing, but it's also counterproductive because the schools in Ontario are, like, we think of Canada being this egalitarian place, but if you look at like schools in Black neighborhoods in Ontario, specifically in the Greater Toronto Area, like the amount of funding that can be raised for schools in Rexdale or Scarborough versus like Forest Hill, which is where Drake is from, it's like night and day. Like there's such a wide dichotomy, and it reflects in the way in the grades that these kids earn. So we have these tests called EQAO tests, and like as you move across the geography of Toronto, you can correlate the scores for EQAO tests with the income in the neighborhood. Like it's just a direct correlation. So it's like, why wouldn't you take some of that money that you've made and forget the basketball programs for a second, put money into education like say LeBron James did. Like they, like Americans, I think, see the value of placing money into education to help close both the income gap and the educational gap and the achievement gap. Whereas in Canada, it's like we've adopted a very sort of Eurocentric mentality where it's like, let's create some basketball programs because these kids are not going to succeed in school. And that's how we roll here. I think that Caravana really encapsulates that.
I agree with you. The only difference I would make is that I think the more of a difference is that we at least pay lip service to it. I'm not sure if the actuality is really that much different, but I do think there's at least a conversation here about trying to close the income gap, trying to actually change these things. I just don't think it actually trickles.
Here's the crazy thing about Canada, though. Remember what I talked to you before about hegemony?
Yeah.
You can talk about closing an. I remember I got an email from the Institute for Policy Studies a couple of months ago, and the study that they linked me to, because I'm like all these think tanks, I subscribe to them and I ask them to send me emails and so forth. And the study that they referenced was one I think that was pretty popular a couple of months ago, where they showed that the median wage or the median wealth for Black Americans has dropped by almost half, and that by the year 2082, the median wealth for Black Americans is going to be $0. I'm not sure if you heard about that one.
No.
And then like, the median wage for Black Americans has fallen practically in half over the last 30 odd years, right? It's alarming. It's scary.
Did you post that on Twitter? Because I feel like
I'm pretty sure I did post it on Twitter. But here's the thing that's fucked up about Canada. We will never know that information. We don't even know what median wealth or even median wages look like for Black communities in Canada, because we don't collect the data.
Yeah, see,
that's how efficient this is.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, we have the conversations at least. So, you know, we do have that. I'll give us that, you know?
And because we don't have the data to prove this stuff, then we're stuck in conversations like, let's give these basketball kids some basketball courts. Nets.
Now, here's my question about Drake, right? Because I've like known about Canadian hip hop for a while, like from the days of Chalk Claire, Maestro Fresh West, the Swollen Members. And there are a lot of people, Cardinal Official, who to me personally, I thought they were as good as a lot of Americans. And I thought they were like better rappers, like more lyrical than Drake. I'm very curious, what was the, do you think about Drake that-
what was the difference? Okay, here's my theory, right? I'm going to refer back to Nipsey again, but you know, here we go. One of the reasons I like Nipsey a lot is because he kept that West Coast flavor, like the West Coast flavor just existed in his music throughout his whole discography, right? Like he didn't really try to assimilate into that, like that 808, like that Southern sound.
Yeah.
He did his own thing, right? The thing about Canadian hip hop is that we were almost like New York in the sense that we were like lyrical elitists. So we focused so much on the lyricism that it's like, but is this catchy? Like, are people going to want to listen? And that's not to say that, like, you know, Cardinal and Socrates, Chocolate, et cetera, weren't making catchy music. But I think it was kind of at a time where, like, that was when New York reigned supreme in hip hop music. And they just like exercised like a dominance over the market that kept everybody else out.
Yeah.
And I think that Drake was very fortunate to come into a time when it was transitioning away from New York and more towards the South. And it's easy to imitate that, like, it's easier to imitate that Southern flavor and to blend in, which is why like a lot of acts sound very similar. Like Designer, for example, like you listen to the guy's music, you can't even tell he's from New York. He sounds
but that's a lot of New Yorkers now. Like Tekashi 6ix9ine didn't really rap like a New Yorker. ASAP Rocky just sounds like you know,
like anybody. So I think Drake was fortunate to come in at a time when it's like anybody could sort of jump into this particular sound and get popping off it. But, you know, back in like, you know, the second wave of Canadian hip hop, which is the artist that we just mentioned, you know, it was really hard to break into the market because it was just dominated by certain artists. And
they did kind of have a unique sound, like that you could tell they were might have been from Canada. Like
you listen to Cardinal Official, you know he's from Toronto. Like he's the most Toronto sounding Toronto man's in existence. So like you knew that. But I think when, you know, you have somebody like Drake who's like a
chameleon kind of.
Yeah, exactly. He's a verbal chameleon. Like he will just like blend in with whichever genre of hip hop happens to be going well at the moment, and he can just drop back into his Toronto man's identity at any point in time. So I think it was less a matter of like you know, skill or ability, and more so it was just like the zeitgeist at the time.
So I guess my second question is, why not anymore after him? Like there was a guy called P Rain, I think his name is now Preem, who was good, and I'm like, okay, maybe this guy's gonna be next, and he never.
Well, you got Tory Lanez, right?
Man, listen, it is so
hard. Is Tory Lanez Canadian? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Tory Lanez is from
Chicago. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Tory Lanez is, he's Canadian also. Like, there are a few, you know, around here. You know, The Weeknd is Canadian, right? Like,
yeah, I know The Weeknd is Canadian, but that's R&B, so I kind of...
But yeah. Weeknd, he's also from here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
I mean, more straight-up rap. Like The Weeknd, because he's a singer, I feel like...
I know what you mean, though. But, like, yeah, Tory Lanez is, he's also you know, Scarborough.
Singer.
Yeah, but he can also flow. Like he's got. I'm not trying to defend Canadians. I'm just saying, like
he's a good rapper. I was very surprised when he had that beat.
At everything he does.
But singing, I'll tell you what,
thing, the rapping thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you ever heard about this. There's a Canadian Music Awards called the Junos. I'm not sure if you ever heard this story that the Junos invited Drake to perform, but then even though he was like smashing records left, right, and center, and he was winning awards like all over the place in the United States, he did not win a Juno Award here. And for years and years and years, he was like, I will not fucking perform there. And he was right to do it. Canada is the most elite, like we are so culturally elitist. We do not recognize urban music talent here until they go to the United States, get big, and then come back, and we praise them to the high heavens. I think that was Drake's experience to a great extent, is that he had to get in with Lil Wayne. You know, he had to like get into the American machine and be accepted, and then be bigged up by then to come back here for us to celebrate his achievements. And that's the case for a lot of Canadian hip hop artists. And I'll give you a very good example. A friend of my family used to be the head of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. And so he, you know, ended up leaving there in ignominy due to a divorce case that went really ugly. But, you know, he would tell me, he's like, Andre, do you understand that the amount of money, they don't even apply for these grants, but the money that the TSO, the Symphony Orchestra, gets from the City of Toronto and the Government of Ontario, the amount of money that they get is something like 5 times the amount that every single urban music program in the province gets combined. Wow. There is so much subsidy for a particular kind of culture in Canada. But the thing is, nobody fucking cares about the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. Like, when is the last time you ever heard about anybody who, you know, went there to celebrate them? If anything, you're hearing about, you know, orchestras in like New York, in Boston, in Paris. The Toronto Symphony Orchestra has like no clout. What has clout? Canada, because our biggest cultural export, again, is urban music. But we put no energy or innovation in towards it whatsoever. You look at like Cirque du Soleil. The reason that Cirque du Soleil became a globally known act is because of the amount of time, energy, and money that the Quebec government put into making it one. But Canadians in government do not value urban culture. It's almost like we will accept the credentials that it gives us, which is why you saw that fucking culture vulture Norm Kelly, that city councilor from up here. You know, he was like riding on that Drake clout. You know, the mayor of Toronto.
It was kind of embarrassing. It was kind of embarrassing. It was very much.
Oh my god, it was so embarrassing. And the thing is, like, but he's also a conservative. Like, he was voting against.
Oh, I didn't even know he was a conservative.
He's a huge conservative, man. Like, he was voting against, like, you know, up until he was well known for defending Drake. Like, he was voting against like Caravana, and he was voting against like school funding. And
that's even cornier. Like,
oh my God, no. The thing is, they love the clout that and attention that it gets them. They love the cultural cachet that it gets, but they will not put a dime towards supporting Canadian music artists.
Oh, wow. That's something.
So that's why it's so hard for them to make it, because it's like, you can't get recognized on radio stations here. Like, they won't boost you up. Like, even the urban music stations, you know, in Toronto or in Montreal, etc., will not give you the spins until you're verified by the United States. So this is, you know what, this person's hitting the billboards. All of a sudden they'll be getting spins. But the way that like Atlanta nurtures and supports its artists, like, you, there's like a collective in Atlanta that just produces like hit maker after hit maker, you know, going all the way back to like, you know, like Goody Mob and you know, Outkast, etc. Like that sort of like that Sleepy Brown collective that existed in Atlanta. Mm. It's like, but they understood the importance of promoting their own, and you know, the artists would get the spins on local radio, and they would like push their culture as hard as they could. Toronto doesn't do that. We sort of like bar the gates until they're validated from elsewhere.
Mm. Last thing I would like to say is for you to just have the floor, and anything that you think you would have liked to have gotten out during the interview, or say this is your chance to do it.
Put some fire out on some of those bridges you burned.
No, listen, I mean, I don't, I'm not saying anything different on your show that I've said elsewhere. Like, I think people very much understand, you know, who I am and where I come from. So it's like, I'm not saying anything that's completely out of character for me. I guess, like, you know, I don't want to be like, well, you know, Canada is different for X, Y, and Z reasons. You know, I hope I can, you know, talk to you guys more often and so forth. But I guess what I really want to impress on American audiences is that, you know, the problems that you experience in the United States, like, maybe we don't experience them to the degree of, like, you know, violence and brutality, et cetera, in Canada. But that white supremacist hegemony exists to such a greater extent here that you almost don't have to. And when you have conversations with Canadians about like whether racism exists up here and to what extent it's different and so forth, like, just understand that we are part of a colonial project that actually succeeded. The worst thing that could actually happen for the United States and for black people in the United States is for it to become more like Canada. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Oh man,
one thing I remember to give an example of how Americans kind of a Pollyannish view of Canada. One time we went up there and we met some girls, right? And they were like beautiful girls. And they were like, yeah, you know, we live in, you know, what's basically like the public housing, the projects, you know, Toronto. And in America, when some girl says she lives in the projects or the public housing, your alarm goes up, not because of a classist thing, but sometimes, and this is not me being classist or whatever, but sometimes, like, you know, girls from the projects might set you up, you know? If you go over there, like, is that something like, you know, you don't want to just go over to somebody's projects and you don't know anybody from there except for these girls. Exactly. And you don't
set you up to get your pockets.
Yeah, exactly. So I just want to make sure people don't think I'm saying, oh, I'm better than them. It wasn't that. It was like, okay, we got to have our head on a swivel. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And you showed us pictures of the projects. We're like, wait, these are your public housing? You know, and then that's an example of things that I think Americans see.
Well, make no mistake, though. No, make no mistake. Like, you know, I don't want to get into, like, you know, the comparison of oppression. And I don't want to get into poverty tourism. But, you know, like, I have had the same experience. Like, I had family that lived in the Bronx in the 1980s. And when I would go, I went to the Bronx. And I saw what the projects were like there. And I was like, man, it's not that bad. It's like, it's not as bad as I've seen in the movies. Like, we have, you know, I think very warped perceptions of each other that come through media. Yeah. And also through, like, our anecdotal interactions. But, like, you know, I could take you up to some places, and I think it's different now than it was, more so than, like, in the 80s and mid-90s, etc. But, like, there were certain places in, like, Regent Park you could not go to, and places in Jane and Driftwood that, like, if people didn't know you, like, you didn't go up there. If fans knew that, you know, you were from Rexdale, you go up to Jane and Driftwood, you better, like, have, you know, a tourist or somebody to vouch for you. You know, so I think a lot of that stuff, it translates over. Like, it still does exist. But I think that
the grass is greener.
It is, but also, like, the highest concentration of, like, Black people that you get in any, like, in any city in Canada. I think, actually, the city where I live is, like, one of the blackest in Canada. I think the concentration here is, like, close to 30% Black people. I'm out in Pickering, Ontario, right? Like, in like, Brampton or in certain neighborhoods in Toronto, like, you'll find a high concentration. But, like, it is just so white here that it's, like, easy to just, like, go to, you know, a tourist location in Toronto, or to see, like, a subdivision that might be considered lower income in Canada, be like, oh, it's not so bad here. But it's like, but you have to really go into the pockets where the Black folks live, and then you really see what it's like.
Okay, so yeah, I think that's a good place to end it. Thanks for joining us today. It was a good time.
Sure,
appreciate. Yeah, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's appreciated, and look forward to our chats.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. And you're always welcome on if you have anything you want to promote or anything. Just let us know. And yeah, so that's about it.
Make sure to send the link for that article that you got coming out.
Oh yeah, yeah, the couple of articles that I do have out, I'll send you guys a link for that.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good, man. All right. So have a good night, man.
Yeah, man. You all take it easy.
All right. Cool.
All right. You too, brother.